Officials in Germany are attempting to get to the bottom of a weird incident in which thousands of dead fish washed up in a town's harbor. The strange event reportedly occurred in the community of Wolgast last week as residents woke up to discover the macabre collection of dead sea creatures floating on the water. All told, the blanket of dead fish covered a whopping 1,600 square feet. In perhaps the most puzzling aspect of the case, authorities noted that many of the fish appear to have had their heads cut off and their bladders removed in an almost mechanical fashion, which has led some imaginative observers to speculate the creatures could have fallen victim to some kind of paranormal event akin to the cattle mutilation phenomenon. While that seems a bit doubtful, officials in the town have yet to offer any possible explanation for the inexplicable event. And you can read more about the story and see the video in the highlights carousel where our webmaster Tim Banal has posted that up at coasttocoastam.com. Back to more of my conversation with Jason Jarrell as we discuss native cosmology and your phone calls at the bottom of the hour on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett, sitting in for George Norrie, and investigative historian, avocational archaeologist, and author. Jason Jarrell is with me. Ages of the Giants, A Cultural History of the Tall Ones in Prehistoric America, which he co-authored with Sarah Farmer. Now, where did giants fit in with Native American cosmology? Did the giants, did they arrive in North America before Native Americans, or did they coexist? Tell me about that.
Well, to begin with, they were a recurring element in the general prehistoric population of North America that goes back to the original founding groups who entered the continent from Eurasia at least 20,000 years ago. They were not guaranteed any type of status or leadership positions by virtue of their unique physicality. This is testified by the fact that while they're found in group burials, just carelessly dumped into a pit in some of the ancient tombs, in other tombs they are found with exotic goods, which suggests that some of them had leadership positions. But, in fact, they were actually a part of the base population. And they actually continued up to historic times when they were documented among the existing Native American tribes.
And you do a lot of work investigating mounds up and down the Ohio Valley. Were these burial mounds used to entomb these giants, or were they used for non-giants as well, members of the non-giant population?
Well, most of the population was made up of people without the unique physicality. The burial mounds, which form the primary focus of my research, are of the Adena and Hopewell mound-building cultures in the Ohio Valley. Together, these cultures date to between 500 B.C. and roughly 500 A.D., and the burial mounds of these two cultures, these earthwork building cultures in the Ohio Valley, have been found to contain more unusually large skeletons than the tombs of any other ancient culture from anywhere else in the history of the world. Now, the burial mounds themselves were built to contain the remains of local community members, and in some instances, individuals from multiple regional communities, and they were built for the entire population. The reason that the tall ones and the large skeletons are so famously known from these mounds is because the cultures themselves are so famous and exotic. But one of the things we found in researching Ages of the Giants was that these remains are actually found in all of the cultures going back to the archaic period here in the eastern woodlands and the Great Lakes region of the United States. And people with this unique physicality were born into the historic period. In fact, many of the old press articles that describe large skeletons from burial mounds that have been promoted as ancient giants are actually burials that were made in mounds that were very recent, some of them after European contact, because the remains are found with Spanish trade goods in some instances. So essentially, they're a part of the population that constructed the exotic mound builder cultures, but they are also a part of all of the other ancient cultures from this part of the country. They are in the ancestry of the Algonquian, the Sioux, the Cherokee, the Iroquois, the Caddo, Pawnee, the Creeks, and other indigenous peoples from the eastern United States.
Now, we're not talking about, you know, 12-foot giants or anything extraordinary like that. We're talking about what, on the order of 7 foot, 7.5 feet?
Well, that's a really excellent point, and that's why I refer to them myself as the tall ones. It's not only a much more appropriate descriptive term, but it is also the term which was used for them by the tribal elders consulted by the great Native American scholar Vine Deloria, who published about this in his book Red Earth, White Lies in 1997. The actual reports of archaeologists that acknowledge the large remains going back to the excavations of the Smithsonian in the 1880s are describing people who range between 7 and 8 feet in height, with very powerful musculature, as evidenced by the attachments which are detectable and observable on the bones, very thick skulls, who practiced artificial cranial deformation. Their facial skeleton was also very pronounced and powerful. They had large brow ridges, but it's been well known since the mid-20th century that these people did not have any type of disease that caused these traits. They were studied by numerous physical anthropologists from Ohio and Illinois and other places, these bones. So there was a genetic component to this. It just happens to be a very widespread genetic component.
So why the controversy? Why, for example, do we not see the remains of these tall ones in the Smithsonian or other museums? Why, as some researchers claim, has it been suppressed?
Well, first of all, you're not seeing remains because the burial law and the laws regarding the respect for Native American human remains at this point strongly discourages the display of any remains from prehistoric tombs that are in the ancestry of Native Americans. But in terms of the policy of denial, the reason why this subject became blacklisted in the first place really has nothing to do with modern archaeology whatsoever. It goes back to the beginning of the 20th century when eugenicists and scientific racialists took over the hierarchy of the Department of Anthropology at the Smithsonian, and a man named Elias Herdlicka initiated a policy of denial by which the Smithsonian would refuse to acknowledge the large skeletons in their own reports. And the reason for this was that at that time, the American Eugenics Society had targeted Native Americans in the United States for complete extermination. And they believed that the existence of these anthropologically superior people in Native American ancestry would contradict their own racist dogmas.
So, in other words, the tall ones had physical characteristics which were, just based on their size, superior in that way. That's what you're referring to. Their physicality didn't fit the narrative, didn't fit the narrative of European superiority.
Yes, what people need to understand is that the eugenics movement worldwide in the late 1800s and early 1900s based a person's genetic quality solely on the types of bones their ancestors left behind. If you go and research the writings of all the major eugenicists, including American eugenicists such as Madison Grant or the English eugenicist Houston Stuart Chamberlain, who inspired Hitler, you'll find that all of them referred back to the massive stature of their own ancestors as evidence of their Aryan supremacy. So here in Native America, we had a competing gene pool of very large individuals recorded in the Smithsonian's own reports. And it was very well known up to the point that the policy of denial was instituted.
Well, that explains the suppression, let's say, 100 years ago, 60 mm-hmm. years ago, maybe even 50 years ago. But why is the existence of these tall ones still being suppressed in 2019?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons for it. First of all, it's important that we reflect on the field of research as a whole. This information was largely forgotten until just several decades ago, and immediately there were all sorts of sensational ideas and topics attached to it by people who started investigating it and sort of rediscovering it. And this probably caused a knee-jerk reaction among mainstream archaeologists and anthropologists, and in some ways I can understand why, but in terms of simply acknowledging that they exist, I believe that that is actually going to happen, and I don't believe it's going to be very long before it does. There are simply too many of the large skeletons on record. We know of at least three places where they're still being stored, none of which is the Smithsonian. So if there are any enterprising anthropologists out there that would like to double-check this mystery, I can actually help you to do it by pointing you in the right direction.
How would they get a hold of you, Jason?
You can reach me on Facebook, Jason Jarrell, or you can come to ParadigmCollision.com, which is our website, and contact me through that.
And again, Jarrell is J-A-R-R-E-L-L, Jason Jarrell. You can find him on Facebook or the website ParadigmCollision.com. We're going to break at bottom of the hour here. We'll take some calls after the break. Before that, though, I'd like to circle back into some Native American legends and myths. And we have to talk about the skinwalkers. Where do these shapeshifters fit into Native American cosmology?
Well, in terms of shapeshifters, I would really like for people to understand that shapeshifting, at least in this part of the country, in the Northeast, as a Native American belief, it's attached literally to everything. You know, the cosmos was fluid and continuous. It's apparent by reading the Native American oral traditions as they were documented by the ethnographers in the 1800s. That shape-shifting was a power attributed to any being with spiritual abilities, including human beings. If we go back to the earliest cultures, we see that the three realms of the Native American cosmos are connected by a sacred tree or a great mountain, referred to as an Axis Mundi. The shamans in this layered cosmos, going back at least 3,000 years, the role of the shaman is to travel to the worlds above and below, usually aided by altered states of consciousness. And in order to do so, they would wear the regalia or the bones of certain types of animals, because it was believed that by doing so, they could adopt certain aspects or traits of the animals which could facilitate their journey between worlds. It's for this reason that we see many ancient Adena mound builder burials with parts of wolves, panthers, birds, and bears buried with them. During the era of the Hopewell mound builders, the bear became even more important, and they found a figurine at the Newark Earthworks depicting a priest or shaman wearing the skin of a bear, holding a severed human head. So the concept of shape-shifting became bound up with every form of Native American perspective of the supernatural. Even people who were considered witches and wizards in the historic period were believed to have the power to shape-shift.
Is the idea of a curse part of Native American cosmology? In other words, could a cursed person be destined to sort of walk the earth as a shapeshifter?
Well, there are people who become cursed in the cosmology. For example, the Algonquian lore of the Wendigo is a perfect example. There are several different Algonquian traditions that describe the origin of the Wendigo as a person who began to practice cannibalism and was gradually transformed into the Wendigo. Interestingly enough, there are traditions of black magicians who dealt with the great horned serpent being transformed into a Wendigo as punishment for practicing bad medicine. The great serpent itself granted the ability to shapeshifters. They're also, his followers, are also known to have assumed human form, beings from the underworld, and married human women in order to reproduce with them and create more of their own kind. Historically, the tales of the great serpent from the Great Lakes tell us that individuals had their infants stolen by the great serpents, and people were kidnapped and taken underwater. In some instances, black magicians were required to sacrifice their children or entire families to the underworld serpents in exchange for powerful magic and medicine. So the lore on the subject is very extensive.
Tell me more about the Wendigo. What did they look like, supposedly?
Well, it actually varies from one tradition to the next, you know. Each tribe had its own storytellers. The Wendigo that interests me, though, the most is that there are some forms of the Wendigo in the Northeast that's depicted as a large, white, hairy being. When we see something, a spirit being or a Manitou in Native American cosmology depicted as white, that usually points to the far north. There's a general belief that in the far northern part of the world, north of the Great Lakes, north of America, there's a mythical place where powerful giants and Manitou still live. And when a spirit being or Manitou is depicted in white, even if it's engraved in shell that's white, that it represents some of those beings that still live in the far north.
All right, when we come back, we'll take calls, questions, and comments for Jason Jarrell as we continue to delve into Native American cosmology. And we'll also talk about Bigfoot. Where does the fabled Sasquatch fit into Native American cosmology? Here's the great Rita Coolidge taking us into the break with New Cherokee Morning Song right here on Coast to Coast AM. Sitting in for George Norrie. Authorities responding to a van rollover in California received an out-of-this-world explanation for the accident from the driver. Aliens were to blame. The weird incident reportedly took place Wednesday afternoon when a man cruising along Highway 18 in a mountainous area of San Bernardino saw his van flip over and land on the side of the road. He subsequently called 911 to report the accident and insisted to the dispatcher that it had been caused by extraterrestrials. And according to California Highway Patrol officers who arrived on the scene, the unnamed driver became argumentative with both the police as well as other motorists who had stopped to check out the strange scene. This, of course, is entirely understandable if his story of being pushed off the road by presumably a UFO is to be believed. While one might think that the man's ET tail is an indication that he may have possibly been impaired, that would appear not to be the case, as he was not taken into custody nor cited for the accident. You can read more about it in the highlights carousel up at coasttocoastam.com. Your phone calls, questions, comments for Jason Jarrell, investigative historian on Native cosmology, when Coast to Coast AM continues. Jason, according to Native American tradition, is Sasquatch a physical being of the earth realm? Is it a spiritual being that comes from the underworld, somewhere in between? Tell me.
Well, I'm no Sasquatch or Bigfoot expert, I have to confess. But when it comes to any other than human intelligence with a form of sentience in the Native American cosmos, it's important to remember that they are both spiritual and physical beings. Western science today has taken hold of the material aspect of reality and magnified it to such a degree that it's possible that as we pursue any ancient mystery, we're making the mistake of not using the spiritual perspective as well. So, you know, there are Native American traditions of wood spirits, Wendigo, and things of that nature. If someone were going to investigate something like that on any types of empirical grounds, they would need the proper perspective first.
But do they consider Sasquatch to be sacred, for example?
Well, I'm not entirely sure. It's mainly a Northwestern coast tradition. The Sasquatch, though, as an other than human being, would be considered an entity that could exist between two worlds. That's as much as I can probably say about it.
All right, let's go to Tidewater, Virginia. And Keith, welcome aboard Coast to Coast AM.
Hello, Richard and Jason. Thank you for taking my call.
Our pleasure.
Great, all very interesting. And speaking of sacred, what do you all think about this? Just this week, I watched an 18-part series on YouTube entitled He Walked the Americas. And the short videos are 18 reports of a white man with a beard visiting and teaching and healing and performing other miracles for Native tribes all over North and South America and the islands of the South Pacific and the Caribbean. And it's believed that bearded white man was Jesus Christ. And a few of the things that y'all have spoken of tonight are also mentioned in some of the videos. That series on YouTube has the same title of a book written in 1963 by L. Taylor Hansen, He Walked the Americas. And it seems to be related to a book reported to be written by ancient American Israelite prophets, translated and published in 1830, entitled The Book of Mormon, Another Testament of Jesus Christ, which prophesied of Jesus Christ and also gives an account of Jesus Christ also visiting the people in America 2,000 years ago. And we have reports from 4 to 5 centuries ago that seem to confirm Jesus Christ's earlier visit to the Americas and the islands because of the wonderful welcome and the initial royal treatment, even worship, that so many of the white-bearded European colonizers and explorers received. And that was the case here in southeastern Virginia 412 years ago when the English arrived and settled at Jamestown, America's first permanent English colony. What do you think about that, and have you researched into any of those?
Great question, Keith. All right, Jason, what do you think? Jesus Christ in North America 2,000 years ago.
Well, first of all, I can only report on the things that I actually study, and I have not researched the possibility of Christ in the Americas. But I will say that I would never put any limit on anything that Jesus Christ would do. Even in the Gospels, we're told after the resurrection that he did many, many things that are not recorded in Scripture. He is a limitless being, a limitless God, and he can do whatever he likes, whether theologians like it or not. Had he chosen to visit North America, it would have been no problem for him. But one thing about Christ that really intrigues me is that, you know, he is a perfect symbolic representation of the Axis Mundi and the three worlds. He died on a tree, the cross, on top of a hill, Golgotha. On the hill is the image of a skull, which is why Golgotha is called the place of the skull. After death, Christ descended into the underworld and witnessed against the powers who preside there. After the resurrection in the earth realm, Christ then ascended to the Father in the upper heavenly vault, completing his exploration of the three realms in the gospel story. And we find a representation of all three ancient realms, going back to the beginning of religion here in the story of the death and resurrection of Christ.
What is the concept of an afterlife in Native American cosmology? What happens to our spirit or our soul when we die?
Well, it's very interesting. The soul travels usually to the western edge of the Earth Island or Earth disk when it enters into the starry vault and then takes the Milky Way as a river or path of souls to the entryway to the land of the dead. And in the land of the dead, there's Sometimes it's portrayed as a place where the natural laws of the world we inhabit are reversed. When it is daylight here, it is nighttime there, for example. Sometimes the sun is considered to enter into this land when it sets at the end of the day. There are several interesting figures associated with this land of the dead. For example, there's a lunar goddess who is also an earth mother, known among the Shawnee as Kokomthina, who lives in the land of the dead and takes care of newborn souls as well as the souls of the deceased in a cycle of life, death, and reincarnation. So this general belief system has been found in the people of at least 27 different languages.
In the Milky Way, there is the Great Rift, I believe it's called, and I think the Mayans kind of referred to it as the birth canal of the universe. Does that have any relation to the afterlife in Native American cosmology?
Well, absolutely. This is where, in many of the death journey cosmologies, especially among Central Algonquian peoples such as the Meskaki and the Fox, that a tester is encountered that challenges the soul before it can pass any further. Those who fail the test follow one of the divisional paths perceptible in the Milky Way, and those who succeed follow the other path. And there are many different interpretations for this tester. Sometimes it's a giant wolf-like Cerberus-type creature. In other instances, it's a witch who wants to steal the brains of the souls of the dead. So it certainly has a central role in the death journey cosmology.
Let's go west of the Rockies. Jeffrey's in Seattle this morning. Jeffrey, good morning. Welcome to Coast AM.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question for Brother Jason. I'm originally from southeastern and southwestern Ohio, Yellow Springs area, and I want to ask whether you've had a chance to check out some of the history and tradition of both giants and Bigfoot in the area near Chillicothe. Chillicothe is the ancient ancestral homeland of the Shawnee, and also a little town called MacArthur. That's the gateway to Wayne National Forest. In particular, Wayne National Forest, to this day, is rife with stories of Bigfoot, but also in MacArthur, history and traditions of giants. I just want to throw that question out there to you.
Okay, sure. My first book, Ages of the Giants, is largely centered in that region of the Ohio Valley because it is the epicenter of the Adena and Hopewell mound-building cultures, which is what the book is really about. The giants that have been found in southern Ohio and also northern Ohio, they are predominantly people that were buried in the tombs of the Adena and Hopewell mound builders, although there are some who date to the Fort Ancient period just prior to European contact. With regards to Yellow Springs, it's actually a very beautiful area with a lot of brilliant local attractions. Today, there is strong evidence that we've collected for our next book, actually, that centers on that part of Ohio, revealing the many discoveries of large skeletons in the Adena and Hopewell mounds there and in the surrounding area.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Let's keep it moving with first-time caller Larry in Louisiana. Larry, good morning.
Good morning. You hear me all right?
We can hear you loud and clear. Go ahead.
Okay, in 1965, I went in a museum in Carson City, Nevada, and downstairs there was a mummified woman's body. She was mummified in leather, but her head was unwrapped. And it said she dug her up in the desert there in Nevada. She was 12 feet tall, and she had long red hair. Now, I called about 10 years ago back out there, and there was a man that was still working there in 65, and he said the Smithsonian took her away and wouldn't give her back, citing Native Americans were complaining about what was being done with their ancestors. So I saw one with my own eyes.
12 foot tall. What do you make of that, Jason?
Well, it sounds like a very extraordinary height. I would like to have the opportunity to have a professional measure those bones and tell us more about it. Unfortunately, as he has indicated with his call, once the National Museum gets their hands on something, it takes an act of Congress, literally, for anyone to know anything about it. The vaults of the Smithsonian, just from the mounds that were excavated here in West Virginia in the 1880s are loaded with various bone fragments, artifacts of copper, mica, and shell, pottery and projectile points, which have never been properly categorized. In fact, they're all mixed together in massive trays and drawers. We can't even tell which actual site they came from. The mismanagement of ancient history on the part of the Smithsonian is extraordinary.
All right, Larry, great call. Thank you for that. Let's say hi on the wild card line, and Linda joins us this morning from Windsor, Canada. Linda, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
Hi. This guy is fantastic. You got to come back again just to talk on reincarnation. I heard a story about in our town, we have a park that is called Ojibwe, Natural Park. And the people here just don't take care of it. You know, they want to chop into it, build this there and whatever. But a lot of us, wanted to keep it and even enhance it more. But anyway, doing research on the Ojibwe, I come across this story, and I found it so interesting. It was about there were, in the Atlantic times, when the big destruction happened, there were some people that escaped, and these were very well intelligent people, seers, and they just were extremely much more advanced than we are right now. And a lot of them, or some of them, came to America and Canada and settled. And even they were saying like some of the lost tribes. But I mean, it's so complex. But they didn't want anything to do with technology, because they found out that technology, even as they advanced, they spiritually declined. And it just, they realized that it was leading to a big, nothing. So they kept more spiritual, and they lived more to the land. And that's why they said the Indians, we thought they were backwards, but they really weren't. And it's sort of like inbred in their spirit from their ancestors thousands and thousands of years back. Don't, be on the technical part, but be on the spiritual with the land, Mother Nature, and live with the land. And I found that fascinating, and, I thought, I don't know if it's true, but to this day, that's why there's the prophets, they say, have visions, but they know. They said, if a man comes from, like, say, Europe, like a white man, if he comes with a sword, there's going to be trouble and turmoil, but if they come in peace, it's going to be, a better world. Well, I don't think it was a white man. They just said whoever the man is when they come over. And it wasn't in peace, obviously. And our technology, I don't think it's done us. I mean, it's progressive, but I don't think spiritually we've kind of, went downwards. But.
All right, Linda, let me get Jason in here to comment on that quickly, if you could, Jason.
Oh, well, This is actually important. The Lord of the Underworld, Mishibishu, offers promises of life extension, abundance of food, and powers of great destruction. And if you look at the legacy of super corporations, Big Agra, and the military-industrial complex of Westerners, which we've introduced to this continent, in all honesty, it would seem that the ancient dragons are still with us, but in a new corporate political guise. The colonizations that happened into North America, there was a remarkable opportunity there for peace and cultural growth and evolution for both of our peoples. Unfortunately, it was missed. And I believe that especially with regards to the Ojibwa, the Anishinaabeg peoples, of whom the Ojibwa are a part, have preserved this ancient cosmology and viewpoint to a greater extent than most. And anthropologists are only just beginning to understand how much knowledge there really is in the Ojibwa sacred traditions.
Jason, I can't believe how fast these last 2 hours have gone, but great spending 2 hours with you. Thank you so much. Again, how do people get in touch with you?
Well, you can find me on Facebook, and you can find our website, paradigmcollision.com, and you'll find numerous free articles, interviews, and blog posts there. If you enjoy the information, you can get our book, Ages of the Giants, on lulu.com. That's L-U-L-U.com.
All right, my friend, thank you.
Thank you, my friend.
Jason Jarrell, the website paradigmcollisions.com. When we come back, it's Friday. You know what that means? Well, Saturday morning, it means open lines. And I've got a little log to throw on the fire, a little conversation starter I'll tell you about when we come back. Here is Solomon Burke taking us into the break, and Cry to Me on Coast to Coast AM.